Good evening. Welcome. I'm Mark Hansen. I'm the curator at the Octave Chanute Aerospace Museum, and I'm glad to see you all here. We have a very special evening planned. I think we've all heard stories about the Tuskegee Airmen. If not, we've probably seen the movie. However, that story is much deeper than some of those superficial things that we hear. One thing that most people don't know is that the Tuskegee Airmen as a military organization actually began here at Chanute Field with the activation of the 99th Pursuit Squadron. Most people also don't realize that some of the first Tuskegee Airmen were not pilots, but rather they were ground crewmen. And what we hope to do tonight is to explore a little bit of the World War II story with you, bring the human aspect to it through a snippet of Ken Burns' The War series, but also we are privileged to have folks who actually lived through the Tuskegee experience who will talk with us after the video presentations and, again, put the human face to the history that we often see not quite right. So we are very excited that you are all here, and we're going to have a great evening.
Hi, I'm Kimberly from WILL. I'm the outreach coordinator, and this is Carl Caldwell, our TV station manager. And we're glad to have you here, right, Carl?
I very much so. It's good to see all of you here tonight, and we're excited about this event tonight. It involves a partnership, really, with a lot of people, and I need to thank a number of individuals and organizations here tonight, and so I'll do that very quickly because I know we're all anxious to see the video and to hear some of the reminiscences and experiences of some of the original 99th Pursuit Squadron members. It's quite a reunion here in Rantoul tonight. Central Illinois World War II stories are sponsored in part by WETA, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, SuperValue, East Central Illinois Building and Construction Trades Council, Flooring Surfaces, Clark Lindsay Village. What a partnership. We have a list of them here. The EcoWater Systems, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, number 601, and Strawberry Fields. Thanks to all of those organizations. This is an exciting event because as much as we're all looking forward to the Ken Burns documentary, which premieres this Sunday evening, September 23rd, one of the things that this whole project has enabled us to do is to reach out to people here in Central Illinois to get the local perspective on this terrible conflict that took place in the 1940s, the early 1940s, and the impact on American life after Pearl Harbor Day on December 7th, 1941. It's great to hear the national perspective, and Burns does a tremendous job in telling the stories of individuals from four states in the country, Connecticut, California, Alabama, and Minnesota. But we are given the opportunity to reach out and talk to individuals here in Central Illinois who lived through this. Not only the combat experience, but people on the home front. And one element of this story is the experience of the Tuskegee Airmen. And that's why we're particularly delighted to be here tonight and welcome the opportunity to hear their experiences. And also we hope to hear some of the experiences from you in the audience. So again, thank you, and we're looking forward to a great program tonight, Kimberly.
Yes, thanks, Carl. We want to say that a lot of what we're doing, both in the community and on radio and television, is on our website. We're going to be videotaping this event tonight. It'll be on our website. Many of the local TV stories that Denise LaGrassa has been working on and our radio reporters are on our website. They're airing right now. The local stories will air after the Ken Burns, so if you watch that, you'll get the local stories as well. So please look in your patterns guide for all the local stories that you won't want to miss. World War II took place between 1939 and 1945, and 50 to 60 million men, women, and children died, and the vast majority were civilians. 85 million served in uniform. About 16 million were Americans. About 405,000 airmen, soldiers, and sailors from the U.S. perished in the war. Will you join me in a moment of silence to remember the military men and women who died and were injured and the civilians who were injured and killed? Thank you. And I'd like to acknowledge some other local veterans who are here. If you could just raise your hand. We have a Mr. Freeman, who is going to be in one of our local stories. Mr. Freeman, could you raise your hand so we can acknowledge your participation? And Mr. Woolard, who also served. Mr. Woolard, could you raise your hand? Thank you. We want to acknowledge your presence here, as well as our guests, who we'll get to in a moment. We want to now turn it over to State Senator Mike Frerichs, who'd like to make a few remarks.
An airplane can't fly without its pilot, but unless that airplane is kept in great condition, the pilot can't rely on his plane. Those brave pilots, known as the Tuskegee Airmen, were supported by members of the 99th Pursuit Squadron, based out of here, former Chanute Air Force Base. They were the first African-American pursuit squadron in American military history. While not all intended for their enrollment to serve as a catalyst, the foundation of the Tuskegee Squadron increased opportunities for African-Americans to serve their country. Over 250 enlisted men were trained here in Rantoul for ground support roles, where they formed the core of the famed units that supported the North African and Italian campaigns, as well as protected Allied bombers on their missions into the heart of an occupied Europe. For 28 weeks, these men worked hard, learning the ins and outs of the aircraft they were going to eat, sleep, and breathe in for the next few years. Instructors said cadets caught on quickly and were a real credit to America's conflict with the Axis powers. Members of the 99th Pursuit Squadron served as armorers, metal mechanics, aircraft mechanics, parachute riggers, clerics. And after the war, many of them went home to serve their own communities. Tonight, we're here to recognize these heroes for their contributions to our country. It gives me a great source of pride to know that I grew up in and represent an area with such a proud history in our country. So thank you all for coming out here this evening and being part of the celebration. And like you, I very much look forward to their speeches and to the stories. Thank you.
And we want to thank the Air Museum for their partnership. It's been great working with Robin and Mark and others, and Howard Piggy, who's our moderator today. So first we're going to see about a 12-minute clip from the war, and this series is called The Four Towns, and you'll hear from a civilian perspective what it was like to live in the war during that time. And then we will introduce a local piece that was done here at the Air Base, including interviews with Mr. Colonel Jones, about the 99th Pursuit Squadron, and then we will have our live panel. And we're hoping that you and the audience will have questions of the panelists so we can make this an interactive evening tonight. So if we could have the projector on. Jeff, you'll need to just hit that button to make the... Okay, I'll help with that.
One evening in the summer of 1941, several months before the United States would be drawn into the Second World War, in a little farming town in Alabama, a 16-year-old high school boy named Glenn Dowling Frazier discovered that the girl he loved was interested in someone else. Frazier was so angry and upset that when the owner of a juke joint refused him service, he stalked outside, climbed onto his motorcycle, and roared through the door, shattering bottles and smashing furniture. As he raced away, the bar owner chased him down the street with a shotgun. The next morning, humiliated, scared, and unable to face his parents, Glenn Frazier went to the nearest recruiting office, lied about his age, and joined the peacetime army. He volunteered to serve in the Philippines.
When I volunteered for the Philippine Islands, I had no idea that we would actually be in war. I was thinking that probably Germany was the most likely place that there would be a war. So in my mind, I thought it'd be safe over there. I never thought Japan would be attacking us.
Over the next 4 years, Frazier would find himself in the midst of war. Desperate hand-to-hand combat. A forced march so brutal, the world would never forget it. And nightmarish prison camps, where simply surviving required luck and bravery and unshakable will. Back in Alabama, those who loved him would be told he was dead. All Glenn Frazier would be able to do was cling to the hope that one day he could come back home.
I don't think there is such a thing as a good war. There are sometimes necessary wars. And I think one might say just wars. And that I never questioned the necessity of that war, and I still do not question it. It was something that had to be done.
The greatest cataclysm in history grew out of ancient and ordinary human emotions. Anger and arrogance and bigotry. Victimhood and the lust for power. And it ended because other human qualities, courage and perseverance and selflessness, faith, leadership, and the hunger for freedom combined with unimaginable brutality to change the course of human events. The Second World War brought out the best and the worst in a generation and blurred the two so that they became, at times, almost indistinguishable. In the killing that engulfed the world from 1939 to 1945, between 50 and 60 million people died. So many, and in so many different places, that the real number will never be known. More than 85 million men and women served in uniform, but the overwhelming majority of those who perished were civilians. Men, women, and children obliterated by the arithmetic of war. The United States of America was relatively fortunate. More than 405,000 soldiers and sailors, airmen and Marines, died. But that figure represented proportionately fewer military casualties than were suffered by any of the other major combatants. American cities were not destroyed. American civilians were never really at risk. But without American power, without the sacrifice of American lives, the struggle's outcome would have been very different. The American economy only grew stronger as the fighting went on. And by the time it ended, the United States would be the most powerful nation on earth. And a once isolated and insular people would find themselves at the center of world affairs. The war touched every family, on every street, in every town in America. towns like Luverne, Minnesota, Sacramento, California, Waterbury, Connecticut, and Mobile, Alabama. And nothing would ever be the same again.
I'm not sure I can speak about why human beings in general go to war. I think that's a pretty large category. I can only speak about why 18-year-olds from Minneapolis go to war. They go to war because it's impossible not to, because a current is established in the society so swift, flowing toward war, that every young man who steps into it is carried downstream.
In 1941, the U.S. was divided along racial lines. But in one small central Illinois town, nearly 300 men were attempting to break down barriers. The Chanute Air Force Base in Rantoul not only proved essential in helping pilots who played a large role in World War II, it started the integration of the military. Today, that site is known as the Octave Chanute Aerospace Museum, and recently became home to an exhibit honoring the ground support crew known as the 99th Pursuit Squadron. These men were among the first to be part of the experiment known as the Tuskegee Airmen. But nearly 70 years ago, they were more concerned with doing their job than making a statement.
We all recognized that we were being brought into the Air Force on a segregated basis. But, you know, we didn't talk about that. You know, I'm surprised as I think back of it. I mean, that didn't concern us at all.
Colonel Elmer Jones was among the first six black aviation cadets, where the other trainees and superiors were white.
We got along well. Of course, when it was dinner time, we had to go back to our barracks, which were World War I barracks. And they had been modified to accommodate us, you know, the cadets in part of that building.
In the early 40s, hundreds of other enlisted men became the core of black squadrons forming in Alabama. Prior to this time, all combat pilots had been white. But with a series of congressional moves, the military's color barrier was broken, and the U.S. Army Air Corps was forced to form an all-black combat unit. But in order for any black man to become a pilot, ground crews needed training well ahead of them.
Other bases weren't interested, didn't want black airmen on their base. And so Chanute was one of the best technical training bases that the Air Corps had. And it didn't seem to have a problem with having these guys come here, though it was segregated. And so they came to Rantoul, Illinois, and did all the first group of the 99th did all their training here, that 28 weeks. They trained armorers, metal mechanics, aircraft mechanics, parachute riggers, clerks, just about any person who was on the ground, any non-pilot job, that first group was trained here at Chanute.
Instructors said the cadets caught on quickly, and their grade point average hasn't been equaled since. The group was renamed the 99th Fighter Squadron, and following 28 weeks of instruction, made its way south. In 1943, the first aviation cadets prepared for deployment to North Africa. They saw little aerial combat there, but that changed when arriving in Ramatilli, Italy, a year later. There, the 99th became part of the 332nd Fighter Group, an all-black unit consisting of four squadrons. Pilots say the ground crew workers were essential. Master Sergeant William Searcy was another among the original cadets trained at Chanute.
The pilots always said that we should fly with them. Actually, we did fly with them during their training. And one or two pilots said they wouldn't go up unless we go up with them. They said they want to be sure that the plane operates all right.
The new display at the museum in Rantoul was largely the vision of Colonel Bill Thompson, another among the first six black aviation cadets.
Well, Colonel Thompson, he realized that the Chanute aspect of the Tuskegee Airmen story wasn't given the attention that he felt it deserved. And Colonel Bill was someone who was adamant that when we tell the story, we get it right. He didn't want it romanticized. He wanted the facts, so everyone knew the real story about where the Tuskegee Airmen started. It was here at Chanute.
Thompson died in 2006, unable to see his dream come to fruition. But his photos and financial donations helped tell part of a much larger story on the military's integration. In the first part of the 20th century, segregation and Jim Crow laws not only kept blacks from entering public places like restaurants, but restricted the types of jobs they could hold in the armed forces. But by 1939, the threat of war looming helped the prospects for African Americans to not only hold positions in the military, but become pilots. Many persevered to see the Tuskegee Airmen become a reality, including the NAACP and First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. But the late Chauncey Spencer was one of its pioneers. As a youth growing up in Virginia, when he inquired about taking flying lessons, Spencer was told, "We don't teach colored to fly." But he later got his flight training in Chicago. The National Negro Airmen's Association of America was founded for that purpose. Joined by fellow pilot Dale White, they rented a single-engine biplane and flew to Washington to garner support. There, they had a chance meeting with a senator from Missouri named Harry Truman.
Well, we didn't know that at that time, we didn't know his name was Harry Truman. So he's a senator from Missouri. And he said, "Is that the plane you all flew from Chicago?" And I said, "Yes, sir, that's it." I said, "Would you like to take a flight?" He said, "No, but if you got guts enough to fly that thing from there, from Chicago to here, I got guts to see that you do get into the Air Corps." And he did.
In 1941, the government issued an executive order providing for civil rights and pilot training for African Americans. And Spencer continued his efforts as an executive. Too old to fly by then, he saw to it that his dreams became reality for others. Spencer died in 2002. His wife, Ann, was among those who came to Rantoul last year upon the exhibit's opening.
I don't think he did it for publicity or credit. I don't think he did it for any of those things. He did it because he felt that it was something that should be done, and that's what he spent his life doing. Chauncey did not believe in black and white, and he spent years trying to eliminate the fact that a lot of people judged you by the color of your skin.
The Chanute Air Museum earned Illinois' Association of Museums' 2006 Superior Achievement Award. And recently, the Tuskegee Airmen were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest civilian award bestowed by Congress. The battles on the home front for people like Chauncey Spencer and Bill Thompson are not only what allowed the Tuskegee Airmen to be a success, but allowed their legacy to be preserved today.
Okay, and now you've all been waiting for, we want to introduce Howard Piggy, who will be our moderator today and has worked with WLL for this event. I'm happy to have him come up and say a few words before our panelists come.
Very, very few. I'm actually going to say very few words. What I would like to do is to bring up our three participants, if we can bring them up to the stage. As both Carl and Kimberly have said, during this portion of the event, our participants will be having discussions back and forth around things as we flow, but we're very interested in having you pose your thoughts or your questions to them. One of the only things that we'll ask in operation is that as they think about the question you've asked them, if they wish, they can choose to not respond, and that would be okay with you. It may be that they have forgotten the information or they don't want to broach that particular portion of the subject, and so our discussion earlier in the day was that we would pose that as probably the only criterion in asking you to participate with us in this portion of the program. During that video by that Jeff produced, you got to see pictures, representative pictures of all of the people that we're going to have participating with us this evening. One of the individuals that was there was a young man who heard on the radio that this opportunity was presenting itself, and there were going to be, call it a Negro unit formed, and I understand that he jumped on his motorcycle with no extra shirt, clothes, pants, or anything, and rode over here to the base so that he could be first in line to enlist, and thus he was the first person here. So he enlisted in the very first class as the first person, and this evening we're happy and proud and graced to have with us, his name was Ellsworth Dansby, and this evening we're happy to have with us his wife of almost 40 years, Eunice, who will Dansby, currently Gingrey, who will join us up here at this time. Eunice. There was another young man who was from, I guess, the Monongahela County of West Virginia. Is that correct? And today, if you go and you look that county up, and they chose to put on their website by year two things that make the county famous, that they are known for, and one of the things was the name of this young man. He enlisted. He was commander of the unit. He was in class 42C, graduating, and actually, I guess, became the first black commanding officer of the unit. His name was George Roberts, and his nickname was Spanky. And I'm sure that his wife will be happy to tell us the origin of that nickname. We have with us this evening, from Sacramento, California, Mrs. Edith Roberts. The third member of our panel this evening is a face that you'll readily recognize by the color of the jacket and the conversation that he had with us just a moment ago, a young man from the Washington, D.C. area who still resides in that area today after having joined up with the six original cadets, went on to spend an illustrious career in the military, and upon his retirement from the military, he loved the government so much he went into another role with the as telecommunications leader for the GSA, and he stayed in that role until he retired again, thus influencing several things in terms of policy. His last role in the military was that of the leader for research and development attached to the chief of staff of the Air Force in the Pentagon, and that is Colonel Elmer Jones.
Good
I thought it would be good to open our discussion this evening to allow you to have some additional background concerning both the individuals here and in the cases of the wives, the person that they represent. So in their own words, I'd like for them to talk about so that you have some orientation to the youth of the person who was the participant. And, of course, Colonel Jones will tell you a little of his youth back in Washington, D.C.
You remember
it? Yes. I think so. If you can't read this from the rear, I'm Elmer Jones, born and raised in Washington, D.C., educated in the public school system of that day, which was all segregated, and through Howard University. It was not necessarily a segregated college, but from all purposes, it was mostly a black school, black professors, a few white professors, and the student body was mostly colored. But then if you go to Howard University, you might be surprised to see the large number of whites and foreign students at Howard University. So Howard's doing a great job there. I graduated in 1941 in June, but by May, I was in the Air Force at Chanute Field, and I couldn't even stay for my graduation ceremonies, but I had no problem with that, and I had completed all my work for graduation. And I was awarded a second lieutenant commission of infantry because they had a ROTC at Howard University at that time, and of course there were only two black schools that had that. I was Wilberforce had an ROTC, and so did. So at Howard University at that time. So most of the reserve officers that went into the infantry came from those schools. And so they were after me. I was nearly ready to graduate. And they said, I got orders telling me to report to Fort Devens, Massachusetts for active duty. You know, I didn't want that. Number one, I wanted to finish school. And number two, I didn't want to be in the infantry. So, and I loved airplanes very early in my life. I was born in 1918, which was just about 5 years or so after the first flight at Willie at Kitty Hawk, and so I consider myself one of the children of the aviation age. And so I like to play around with airplanes. When I was in junior high school, I built airplanes. I don't know whether the youngsters of a day do that sort of thing. Of course, the airplane models come in various kits, so you have all the parts there, all you have to do is assemble them. But back in my time, I had to go to the hobby store and buy balsa wood. You ever heard of that light stuff? And silk to cover the airplane with. And I used rubber bands for motors. So I was very much absorbed with that, of course. But then when I went to high school, I took electricity. That was what I liked to do because my father used to build radios, so I wanted to be a radio engineer. And so I built crystal sets and stuff like that. But that hobby served me well until I got in college and was an amateur radio operator, spent a lot of time on the air. talking to other countries, people around the country. But then my opportunity came to get into aviation back in 1939, I think it was. The government started a program called a civilian pilot training program. And the objective was to develop 20,000 pilots a year at government expense. And by sponsoring these courses at universities. And of course, there are about 190 universities involved. And six black colleges were also selected. And Tuskegee was one, Howard University, and Delaware State, I believe, and was Virginia, one of the Virginia colleges, West Virginia State. I may have missed one or two, but there were six out of about 190. And so I was back on aviation. And so I jumped into that program right away. It was my, I guess, sophomore year, and earned my private pilot's license through that program. So then I did pretty well. So they nominated me to go to Tuskegee to take the secondary course. It was a big airplane. In the primary, we flew Piper Cubs. I think most of you people know what that's like, a very light airplane, about 45 horsepower. But down in the secondary, we had a Waco, about 220 horsepower, bi-wing plane, built for good acrobatics. And we had a very good training there. So after the CPT program, the number of black pilots just about doubled. And in about 2 years of service in that in those classes, the number of black pilots were few, perhaps I'll just pull a number out of the sky, 200, and so that was double, possibly added about 400 more. So there were 600 and some black pilots. And of course, the purpose of the program was that, hey, look at the European countries. They're building their airplane capabilities, the fighters and the bombers, and even the commercial airplanes. So we said the president said, we better, you know, get on the ball here and boost up our program. And so the first approach to that was to build up pilots, build a large pool of interested people in flying. So they supported that program. And I think that the blacks proved that they could fly. Now, there was a big study around 1929 in the War College of the Army, and came up with conclusions that said blacks don't have the cranial capacity to fly, and they would be subject to discipline. They wouldn't obey their own officers, and I mean, lack of discipline. And all in all, no, we can't accept them. They can't do the job. So World War II came along, and we had a lot of activists out there. Judge Hastie was one of them. He was an officer of the NAACP, and he was also, at the time, a dean of the Howard University Law School. And so he took this job as assistant Secretary of War, and he was going to hopefully improve the situation of the black in the military across the board. But he felt that they were working around him. They weren't keeping him apprised of what was going on, and the higher up seemed to not to warn us. The armed services didn't want us, and even though we learned to fly, and the
CVT program. So we finally won out in the pressure of the public and a lot of activists and the media and all beating them overhead. And the military or the Air Force announced that they were going to form one pursuit squadron down at Tuskegee, and a base will be built down there for them where they could be trained in a segregated setup. And Judge Hastie, of course, said that that isn't what we want. We want to bring our soldiers into the already operating schools, the flying schools and the other schools involved. But he quit on that for that reason, and of course others, where he felt that he was sort of being circumvented, you know. So he left for that reason. So he wanted us to be really integrated at that point, but they refused. So after going back and forth, the media, the government, the Air Force announced that they were going to form this single fighter squadron to be known as the 99th Fighter Squadron, and they would be trained at this base, segregated base in Alabama, being built for them. So my feeling was that let's get our foot in the door, you know. That's the first step. Let's go along with that program, which we did. And they started recruiting early in 1941. I wanted to mention that Tuskegee Institute was very much involved in getting us started. They were really involved in the CVT program in a big way. Not only that, they were negotiating with the Air Force for contract to train military pilots in the primary phase. You see, for primary, you know, which used a smaller airplane, it was a bi-wing Stearman, about 120 horsepower, something like that. But anyway, many colleges were getting, and other aviation businesses were getting these contracts to train cadets, you know, from the early stage when they first came in as cadets through the primary stage. And I don't know exactly how long that might have been, maybe about 2 months. And we finally broke down that barrier, and most of us knew that we were getting into a segregated setup. And of course, to us, the blacks, we felt that segregation on basis of color was ridiculous anyway. We didn't want it, but I'm glad that we had the good sense to get our foot in the door and to have the opportunity to demonstrate our worth. I mean, the fact that we could do as well as the regular white applicants. So I'll just cut it off at this point, and perhaps I'll be able to respond to some of the questions you might have.
After a bit, yeah. I'd like for you to give us a little bit of the background and youth on Colonel Roberts, if you will.
You want to know about the spanky part first?
Well, you can. That would be good to get that out of the open right away.
George Roberts was 15 years old when he entered West Virginia State College, and he was finished in 3.5 years. So his mother, who was a school teacher in his hometown of Fairmont, West Virginia, and he's an only, well, he ended up being an only child. He had two baby sisters who didn't make it. So this only son of hers, who is a college graduate, he's I guess by that time, 19, he'd had a birthday. And she did not want him to come back to the coal mining community of Fairmont, West Virginia, so she wrote to the president of our college, Dr. John W. Davis, and said, "Dear Dr. Davis, would you allow my son to stay one more year?" I don't know what she thought was going to happen in that year. But her reasoning was, "I don't want him to come back here. There is nothing here for him," which was true. He had two choices as a college graduate and being under 20 years of age, particularly still a kid. I'll get to the spanky part in a minute.
Okay.
He had a choice of working probably in the local hotel, Fairmont Hotel, bussing tables or washing dishes, or he could go in the coal mines. And you would have to know my mother-in-law, those were not options that she thought much about. But Dr. Davis actually let him stay another year. This was not, we had no postgraduate courses at that time. It was straight 4 years. And he allowed George to stay. And in fact, that was the year that I met him. I couldn't stand him at first, but I met him. And that was also the year that he started flying, as Elmer mentioned. Our college was one of those black schools that had a civilian pilot training program. And the rest is history from that point on. Now, the spanky part, he was so young when he went to college, and he hadn't finished growing. And he said he was a junior before any college freshman came in to the school that was older than he was, or no.
Right.
He was the youngest.
He was younger than me.
Right. But anyhow, his roommates, two of his roommates, and his buddies were basketball players and football players, you know, big guys. And they would tease him because he was still very much just a kid. He was a little boy. And because I asked him the same question. We'd been married about 20 years. And I said, "How did you get that name?" And he said, "Well, they teased me so, and I couldn't beat them up. So I tell him, if you don't let me alone, I'm going to spank you." And, of course, remember Spanky McFarland? Those of you are old enough. That was a very popular name. Right. So they started calling him Spanky, and it went on into the military. So that's our chapter name in his honor, George S. Spanky Roberts.
There you go.
That year that he was allowed to stay on campus was the year that I met him. I didn't know that he had known me my freshman year, because that was my sophomore year that I met him. I had no idea that he knew who I was.
He had his eye on you all that time.
Evidently.
Okay.
And because those two roommates, one, I was a music student, and one of his roommates was my friend, also a music student. And the other roommate, I don't know what course Jimmy was taking, but they harassed me. We were all in the college touring choir. And these two guys, they would just, tease 24/7, and they harassed me all that time. I had no idea they had another roommate. And actually, there were four guys. It's a suite of rooms and with a connecting bath. So these other two people, I didn't know who this guy was who was trying to teach me how to operate the school telephone system and the Western Union thing. That was my job my sophomore year, and he was my teacher, and he, being the kind of person that he was, he taught with the, you do this, you flip that, doing very complicated stuff back in 1938, 1939. You do this, you then and punch in here, and you run here, and that's it. And I said, wait a minute, you're too fast. Well, you do, and from that point on, he was on my list. I couldn't stand it. We argued every day because he was so obnoxious. But my roommate loved him because she was a psych major, and he was taking every psychology course that year that the school offered. So they were great friends. And I said, she didn't know why I didn't like him. I said, "Well, you take him. I can't stand him." Anyhow, the rest is history. We were married for 42 years, and four kids, and there sits one of them over there. George.
She's mumbling as you speak.
Now, George was the first of the cadets to be selected for the flying, for the pilot program. He had gotten his license on campus. Like Elmer had mentioned, there were these six black colleges on the East Coast that had civilian pilot training programs, and our school was one of them. West Virginia State University, now we've come up in the world, is one of the original land-grant colleges that the government established after the Civil War to train children of the freed slaves. And so he started flying that year, that extra year that the president allowed him to stay on campus. And when in July of 1941, he was notified that he was selected to go into the pilot training, and he was the first one. He was in the first class. There was a picture up here a little while ago of the first five. There were 13 who started. There were 12 cadets and one cadet officer who was Captain Benjamin O. Davis, Jr., who is a West Point graduate. And his story alone is something you need to read about. But he had wanted to fly once he finished West Point, but he was told there were no classes for his particular color. So he was in the infantry when the flying program started, and he was called in. I like to think, these are my words, he came in to shape up these raw recruits that came out. George left college and went into military. So out of those 13, the one cadet officer and 12 cadets, five of them finished. One cadet, one officer, and four brand-new second lieutenants. And that was March 7th, 1942. And when the ceremony for the graduation, I was there with my mother, George's parents, and Uncle Gene, who was my father-in-law's brother, who went helped drive from West Virginia to Alabama. That was an experience within itself. We were there for the graduation, and George had been writing and saying, I had finished college. I finished in 1941, and we had planned to marry. We just hadn't told our parents. But he kept saying, if I take this program and if we're married, I can't take the flying program because they had to be single. Mm-hmm. So we waited, and he kept telling me, if I can arrange it, after I get through with the training, we'll get married. If I can't arrange it for that day, we'll just get married. And I said, okay, whatever. It'd been 4 years by that time. So I didn't
Plus, you couldn't stand him anyway,
I
right?
I couldn't stand him. But somehow he managed to arrange it. And when the graduation part was over, and I have pictures to prove this, if you're interested, newspaper pictures, by the way, the master of ceremony said, wait, folks, don't leave. We have a wedding to perform. And so everybody just kind of stopped and looked around. You know, I didn't know anybody out there. Well, I knew my mother and I knew his parents. And all. And the chaplain was there, and somebody was plunking on an old upright over there. And this building, of course, see, there was nothing on the base, really, but this makeshift things. This building was used for every gathering, church, movies, the graduation ceremony, you know, everything.
Assembly hall,
thank you. And people just stood and waited, and the wedding, with the, you know, he said, do you? And we said, yes, and it was over, and he was he was gone, and people were saying, oh, congratulations, where's the groom? And I said, I don't know. He said, they had to, the graduates, these brand new second lieutenants, they had to go up and fly. So he had to say, yes, I do, and get in his flight suit and fly. So I had a very, very spectacular wedding. No wedding dress, no wedding dress, no flowers. You know, it was, anyhow, I think it did take, because as I said, we were married 42 years when he died some years ago. But we spent the next 27 years in the military, and in those early days from 19, well, he was gone the whole war time. He came back in 1945. We got sent back to Alabama again. And you have to understand, spot promotions were very common. He was second lieutenant, and then in a few weeks, he was first lieutenant. I was there just before they went overseas. And when he left going overseas, he was a captain. I never saw him as a captain. He came back in 1944, right in the middle of the war, after being gone a year and a half. He was a major. He went right back to combat when the war was in, and he came home. He was a lieutenant colonel. So I was never a junior officer's wife, and I didn't realize that, ladies who are the military, until about 2 years ago. It suddenly hit me. I was never a junior officer's wife. I didn't have time to grow into being an officer's anything. Mm-hmm. Because in 1952, after attending command and staff at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, we found out he'd been promoted to full colonel, only they hadn't told us. It was in the Air Force Times, and a friend called and said, "Hey, I see George made colonel." And I said, "When? How? What?" They didn't notify us first. But that was 1952. This was before schools were desegregated. This was before any of the civil rights, you know, I'm black and I'm proud and all that stuff. This was early. And we came to Chanute after he went to Korea in 1954. And we lived in a goldfish bowl for the next 6 years on this base because George was the only senior type bird colonel, whatever you want to call it. Everybody knew us. We just didn't know everybody else, you know. We lived on Big Staff Row, which is, I saw my old house over there. My daughter after this one was born in the hospital. And it was those 6 years that we lived here literally was my training ground for being a colonel's wife, particularly because I didn't know what I was supposed to be different from what I was normally. Until a young lady in the cleaners establishment here on base, a young black lady, and we used to chit-chat when I take the uniforms in, and she told me one day, we were laughing about something. She said, "Miss Roberts, you don't know anything about being a colonel's wife, do you?" And I said, "I don't know. Why? What's a colonel's wife? I mean, he's the colonel, but what am I?" She said, I'm going to teach you. And I said, okay. What she did was, now, remember, I lived on Big Staff Row, nothing but colonels. And what Flo Henderson, and that's a story right there. Her name was Flo. What she did was to share with me how she was treated by some of the other colonels' wives. She was an she was an employee in the cleaners. Her husband was an enlisted man, so it was, you know, I am Mrs. Colonel so-and-so, and these are my, you know, and I looked down on her, and I said, "Come on, you're kidding." And she said, "Oh, no, ma'am." And I said, "You just don't know." I said, "Well, Flo, I was raised by a mother who taught me to be nice to everybody, even if you hated their guts, so why?" But it was really great training ground for me on this base. I had never lived on a base. We had been stationed several places. In fact, we were at Langley just prior to going to Fort Leavenworth. Oh, that's a story within itself, because the base was the post was 125 years old, and we were the first black family to live in the student housing. There had been other black students at Fort Leavenworth, but they either left their families wherever they were, or they rented out in the town, in the black community. So again, our goldfish bowl, you know, we were really strange. Even the prisoners that used to bag my groceries and carry them out to the car, they couldn't figure out who I was. And the garbage man who collected my hairdresser told me this, they thought I was Chinese when I'd bring the garbage out. But, It was just, everything was so new. And I was often asked, after, especially after he got his Eagles, even here in 1954, 55, until folks got to know me, among the wives, the main question would be, you're Colonel Roberts' wife? And I say, yeah. You have to understand, I still had reddish-brown hair, and I had long hair, and I had freckles, and that always threw people. I didn't look like a colonel's wife. I don't know what you're supposed to look like. But they would ask me, well, what does he do? He's a colonel, and he's military. What does he do? He flies a plane. Oh, he's a pilot. He's not with the hospital. And I said, no, he's not a doctor. At the chapel? No, but his mother would have loved it if he'd been a preacher. You know, what does... It was very difficult for, I guess, the ladies to not be able to pigeonhole me, what his job was. Well, he was commander of the maintenance and supply group here. That's what he does, and he flies to get paid. But that was a very common question, although, what does he do? I thought I was never going to get out of Illinois. We lived here so long. But I realized over time, this was the only training I ever had of being a military wife, because up to that point, I was strictly on my own. What we tried to do now within our chapter, and we have a group of original people, and I tell kids we're called original because we were there at the beginning. That means we're old. But we try to give them a sense of how it was, what was happening, what people's attitudes and reactions were to us, because this was such a new thing. They just... and I'm still running into some people I do have no clue. even my age category, they have no clue the real significance of that little piece of history. Mm-hmm. So we try to kind of educate people. The years I was here, and we had such a great group. My ladies were just wonderful. We had so much fun doing our wives' club things. And George would ask me when I'd get home from a wife's luncheon, how was the luncheon? I said, oh, it was great, or maybe it didn't go so well. He'd say, did you get on your soapbox today? And I said, no, nobody asked me a question. Because, and it's true, I had many friends, and these ladies were from the South, and I think once they got to know me well enough, they felt comfortable asking me questions, things that they, well, why is such and such? And I've always told the truth. I will answer you truthfully whatever your question is. But I realize some of them, well, most of them, I think they really want to know, because none of the segregation rules, the laws, the rigidity of the living impacted them. So they had no way of knowing how difficult it was, just most of the time, just to live and just to be, just to travel, just to, you would drive all night from Alabama to West Virginia.
That's what I was gonna say, but you had to know where to stop.
If you didn't know, you just keep driving. Mm-hmm. No place to go to the bathroom, no place to stop and get a sandwich, a couple of kids in the back of the car, and you drive all night long. And it's helping people today understand what... not racism or bigotry, but what segregation is. It was a law, and that's what a lot of the people I met, it was a law that said we couldn't go here, couldn't go to this school, we couldn't live here, we couldn't eat here. It was a law. But you cannot legislate people's hearts and minds and attitudes. So it begins with you and me, and you and him, and it's a one-on-one thing. That's where it has to start. And I hope by going through the schools that we are helping young people to understand. It's a one-on-one. It's an individual thing. No law can tell you how to feel about another person who is different. I went straight from college into military life. I hadn't even held a job, but well, I had one that 1 year. And, of course, as soon as I finished teaching at that spot, and I went back to Alabama, and then the rest is history. I didn't work, well, I worked like a dog because I had a brand new son. But it was a way of life. I grew up in the military, I guess, sort of. But I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. And I do value my years here. I thought I'd never get out of the country, but it's all right. I made it.
Good. All right.
And guess where I went from here? Okinawa.
All right.
No, that's all right.
Choice spot of the Pacific.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
All right.
But it's such a joy to be back and see what's left. I hate it that, McClellan has gone through the same thing, is going through what you do. We're now McClellan Park. And we have a museum, and I'm waiting to be told how much space they're giving us so we can have our Tuskegee display there.
Right.
But it's really great just to kind of come back, and it's kind of like homecoming for me and for my daughter. She was a kid. Well, she's gone.
She's so excited she went up to look at that house.
She's heard all these stories, yeah. But it's great being back here. Thank you.
Now, how about giving us some perspective?
My husband was Ellsworth Dansby from Decatur, Illinois. He was a very precocious child. He was born in 1914, and he learned to read very, very early. For his third birthday, he asked for a subscription to Popular Mechanics. His father was an excellent mechanic, although his job was making false teeth. He was a huge man, an absolutely huge man with hands like hams, but he could make the most delicate things. And he taught his son to do very well. When he was a little older, I guess I better get him flying first. There were two brothers named Moody who lived near Dalton City, Illinois, on a farm. And they had a plane. In fact, they were real pioneers in Illinois flying. They were white. But Danny, as I've always called him, was a good friend of theirs. He would be a good friend of anybody who had a plane and who might let him get around it. But they were very close. And one fine day, when Danny was 12, he went out to visit. And fortunately or unfortunately, the parents were not home. And so they wheeled the plane out, and one of the boys took it up. It was a single-seater. And he took it up and then landed and said to Danny, "Now it's your turn." Well, Danny had never been in a plane in his life. But does a 12-year-old kid ever say, "I can't do that"? So he got in. He'd read everything he could get his hands on. He said he had absolutely no problem till it was time to land. And he hadn't read that part.
That's when it gets difficult.
But he said he figured out that if he flew it right down to the ground and cut the engine, he would be just fine. And it worked. From that moment on, that was all he could think about was flying. He, for a long time, he ran a program for the YM in Decatur with model planes. And he taught that, and he couldn't be a member of the Y, by the way, but they still thought he could do that much. Generosity, no end.
But he couldn't participate in the Y because of the color?
Right.
Okay.
Then when he was in high school, Mr. Walgreen, was flown in his pontoon plane and landed on Lake Decatur because he was having engine trouble. He was a friend of A.E. Staley, of the Staley Company, now Tate and Lyle, and they brought in every mechanic they could find, and they couldn't get that plane to go. And somewhere along the line, some soul said, well, there's this black kid in high school that you really ought to get down here to look at this engine. And Mr. Walgreen said, well, we've tried everything else. And they brought him down, and he fixed it. He had always wanted to go to flight school, and the family could have never afforded it, never. But Mr. Walgreen said, if you can find a school that you can get into, I will pay for it. But he could not find a school he could get into because he was black. Mm-hmm. But when he was 27 was the day he hopped on that motorcycle and tore up here. And you have to understand that the government never really wanted this experiment to work. Mm-hmm. They put together everything they could think of to keep it from working. And one of the rules was that if you were 27 or older, you couldn't fly. Well, he'd been flying for how many years? What's 12 for 15 years already, and had thousands of hours. And but they took him in as the mechanic, and he became line chief, and he was the first master sergeant in the service, in that service in the 99th. He was offered promotions many, many times, but he said he never wanted to leave his men, and he never did. That was his great love. He had been a pre-med student in college, though he never finished school. And after we were married, we were living in Chicago for a short time, and he was hired by the Atomic Energy Commission. At that time, it was so new that it was still under Wes Stans at the University of Chicago. And he would come home from every now and then and say, guess who walked through today, Fermi or Leo Szilard? It was a very exciting time, and he loved the work. I've never known precisely what he did, and I never will know. because it was classified, and it still is. The one thing I do know is that he wrote the operations manual for the first atomic submarine, the Nautilus. People always ask how we met. This is a great story. You know that some enchanted evening, eyes across the crowded room. Neither one of us had the slightest recollection of when we met the other.
It was an impressive meeting.
Absolutely nothing happened. But somewhere along the line, we did find each other. And of course, you fight two wars then. But, you know, we made up our minds right off the bat that we were going to live as we always would have, regardless of what we did. And we found out pretty early that most people will treat you the way you expect to be treated. And if your expectations are high, that's what you will get. It wasn't all a bed of roses. There were thorns. But when he passed away, his memorial service was wall to wall. There were college presidents. There were politicians from everywhere, both sides of the aisle. He had been selected by the State Historical Society as one of the 32 outstanding blacks who has ever lived in the state of Illinois. And the legislature honored him. I wish he had been there to see it. And maybe he was. But he was a great man. Decatur has a Hall of Fame for their great men. And you have to be dead 5 years to be nominated. Yes. And so I nominated him, and I got back a little note thanking him for the nomination, but he doesn't meet the qualifications. Yeah, one of the 32 in Illinois. What did you want? He's still not in it. And I may try again sometime. Who knows? But he was a great guy. He was fun. He was extraordinarily intelligent. Just extraordinarily intelligent. And when I first began to think about marrying that man, I said to myself, would you marry him if he were white? And the answer was a resounding yes. And I said, well, do you believe what you've always said you believed, or don't you? That was the end of that discussion with myself.
Well, thank you. I wanted the panelists to do that so you would have some feeling for the expanse of their backgrounds, how they got to where they are, some of the things that have affected them, and how they have affected the communities and the world around them. Now, I would like to understand if any of you may have a question or questions that you would pose to our panelists this evening.
I don't have a question, but I want to share with you, I had the honor of being the base historian here in 1983, mm-hmm. and I met some of you gentlemen back then at Black History Week. But Mrs. Roberts, I want to tell you that General McKean and I were involved in dedicating Roberts Hall in 1987. In fact, I have a picture in the library of you and the General cutting the ribbon to enter that hall.
Yeah,
Roberts
I think
Hall
I have
was
that
one of the
too.
Largest dormitories. In fact, it stands today. It's now Prairie Village, but just to let you know that I was there.
Well, thank you. There were several of my family members. I think all the children except, I think, one came that time. And so ever since that time, Roberts Hall has been our building. And when Chanute, like McClellan, was being deactivated and all, one of my daughters, I think it was the youngest one, says, Mom, what are they going to do with our building? And I said, yeah. I have no clue what they're going to do with our building.
So you have to tell her it's occupied by senior citizens today.
You know, my husband would love that because one of the things he did as a volunteer, he went from military to Wells Fargo Bank for about 13 years. When he retired from that, one of his volunteer activities was meals a la carte. And he had more little old people who just loved him to death. They even sent me presents, and I didn't even know them. So I think he'd be very happy about that.
Great. Yes.
Hi, I'm really enjoying your presentation. I lived in Phoenix, Arizona for about 17 years near Luke Air Force Base, and I had a question generally about life around Chanute, and While I lived there, planes would crash once in a while. And most of the time, the pilots would get out. And I was just wondering, was that a regular occurrence around Chanute here? Would there be some planes that would go down? And if so, would I'm sure the whole base would be in a turmoil. And could you share some of those occurrences?
I don't know, is it crashing?
Yes, here? He was trying to understand whether there were infrequent or frequent aircraft crashes on the base here.
Oh, on the base?
Yeah, of the people leaving and departing and returning to the base.
I don't recall the years that we were here. I don't recall, you know, a lot of them. That doesn't ring a bell at all.
No, it doesn't ring a bell with me.
Mm-mm. So this was evidently a very safe place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to count the fact that the runway was so short till nothing really heavy duty would come or go. Are there others who may have a thought or a comment or a question?
Colonel Jones, like the cadets who trained here with the original 99th, I think, did you have expectations that you were going to be a pilot?
No, I knew what I was getting into when I went into this cadet training as a technical officer. I wanted to fly. I loved airplanes. And as I've grown older and looked at the statistics, I said, well, maybe I wouldn't be here today.
Maybe you chose the better course. Huh?
That's right, because, let's see, even in the CPT training program, there were three of my classmates that survived that program but were killed on active duty. And out of the class of 10 of the secondary pilots training program at Tuskegee, Yancey Williams was killed in an airplane. And his commander of the 99th. Lawrence was in the 99th.
He was Wayne killed. Lawrence?
He
was
killed,
killed
overseas.
Combat.
Uh-huh. There's another one in my class.
And there's several, maybe
Williams.
Others.
Well, yeah. The statistics were brought me down to my senses.
It's enough of those flying
heroics.
But
I would have gone for it. I mean, you think differently when you're a younger person. And those kinds of things don't worry, but now as I think about it, many of my pilot friends are not here with us. Real heroes. May I make one point that I wanted to make sure that I've gotten over? Maybe I didn't make it strong enough, but you know, most of us that came up in those years, and even now, hate the word discrimination based on race. And some of our people, as I told you, Judge Hasey, he quit his job as Assistant Secretary of the Army. He left because they wouldn't integrate us into the existing facilities. The regular fight programs. But do you know, as looking back on it, I think when we were all together, number one, we had good friendly bond. You know, we used to work together, like each other, help each other. And another thing is that if we had spread and taken into the other facilities, we would have spread out through, thousands of Air Force pilots and ground crews, and I think that we would have sort of gotten lost. There would have been some outstanding pilots and some outstanding enlisted men. But when we were all together, we had a purpose, and I had to make a statement, and we did, leading up to this recognition by Congress after 60 years, but You know, I think that if we had been integrated completely, that we would not have gotten the recognition that we get today.
No, wouldn't have had the same impact on the country.
It worked for us at that time. We got our foot in the door, and as we proved our worth, then we were eventually taken in completely to the armed forces. And our activities in the war, of course, helped the integration of the entire military forces of the country.
And
it had a big impact on our society. Mm-hmm. You know, people thought we were worthless and not as good as they. And all of that now has been proven wrong. So I just want to leave that point with you.
Can I piggyback on that?
Of course.
I find in our going about and doing this history thing that many people don't equate Tuskegee Airmen with a civil rights activity. And any school kid today knows that Dr. King and Mrs. Parks initiated civil rights. Well, and I tell them with all due respect, civil rights, well, for black people, we've been trying for 400 years, but I'm not going to give you 400 years of history.
Okay, good.
But
I was going to ask you, like your husband, did you get on your box?
No, but think of that little piece of history. It had never happened before. It will never happen again. That was a civil rights activity that, other than killing up a few Germans and Japanese, I guess, we didn't do it violently in this country. We did the job and did it so well that it just proved that, you know, your color doesn't have anything to do with up here, contrary to what that study did that said that black brains are smaller than the white brain. That was after World War I. That was a conclusion. And they determined that this program then wouldn't work because it's an established fact that the black soldier is not capable. So it was a civil rights act, that little piece of history, and it did a lot of things that we're trying to get that point across to. It's not about some black guys flying. It's about our country and what was happening at the time and the end result. So for me, that's the important thing, and I'd like the younger generations to know that.
During the 40s, a black and a white person couldn't walk down the streets of Decatur without being arrested. And they could even be two guys or two women. Arresting was entirely possible. A lot of us did a lot of sit-ins in restaurants, but they got integrated in the darndest way. There was a student at Millikan. If you put this on the air, you better take his name out. He may still be alive somewhere. His name was Herbie Quarles, and Herbie was from the Deep South. And I'm not sure the elevator went all the way to the top anyway. But somebody had told him, when you cross the Mason-Dixon line, you're in heaven. So he's just sort of wandered around in a fog of joy. Well, the campus bar, the winery, was not integrated. But Herbie got the desire that he wanted a drink there. So he wandered over. Sit-ins had been going on everywhere, and nobody had gotten anywhere. He wandered over and wandered in there, sat down. They looked him over. What do you want? A beer? He got it. And it was integrated.
All right. yes.
See, more simple approach.
Very simple.
Right?
Yeah, I'm wondering, what was the response in your unit when the segregation or integration of the forces took place? I know I was in 1949 in Tampa, Florida, when they integrated our unit in the Air Force, and they still had integrated units in Korea when I was over there in 1950.
You mean segregated units?
Segregated units, yes. Uh-huh. And I was wondering, what was the reaction amongst the blacks at that time as to what their thoughts were when this occurred?
I'm not understanding.
His question was, at the time when the president issued the executive order to desegregate mm-hmm. the military, and as that process began and the units were dissolved and moved out into all of the other units, what were the thoughts of our people that were involved in that? Did they think it was a good thing? Was it a frightening thing? What were their thoughts about that?
I can't answer that question, but the time period, as I mentioned, George made colonel in 1952, and he had to take some advanced jet training before going to Korea by 53, and he was there a year. He was commander of an outfit there, of the 313th Air Division, and near Seoul. Mm-hmm. That's all I know where he was. But it was an integrated unit. Mm-hmm. In fact, he has a distinction, I didn't know this until some years ago, of being the first black officer to command an integrated, it was a squadron at Langley Air Force Base.
Okay.
There was no housing for us. We bought a house so we'd have somewhere to live, but his unit was integrated, mm-hmm. and he was the commander mm-hmm. of that outfit, and that had not, at least hadn't been done at Langley, but I think I was, he told me that he was the first one to do this integrate, and this was 1950.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, it's working one-on-one, and, you know, dealing with people, once you get beyond what color they are and find out who the person is, I can't speak for anything else, you know, or other units, but I can only talk about us.
Your experience,
and,
yes.
Well, under the law, each service was requested to set forth the headquarters their plan for integration, for complying with this regulation. I forgot what the number was, integrating the services. But I think that the Air Force sort of led the way in, you know, time-wise in getting
so.
Integrated. And the Navy was a little slower.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly where the Army fit in, but they each had their own approved program. What did I say?
No, they were kibitzing out there.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, sometimes I don't mean to be funny.
No.
Sometimes.
That's all right.
I'm surprised at what I said. Maybe I could use it again. But anyway, they all submitted their own plans for integration.
Yeah, their own timetable.
Yeah,
that's right. It wasn't all of a sudden,
so
but each one it depended
services
on.
Services like the Air Force has led the way. They were a little slower than some of the other services.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Are there other questions that you may have? Yes.
I have a question.
Just a moment. She'll get you the mic.
We heard a lot from the origins in the southern part of the country, the East Coast and Central Illinois. What about the internment camps in California where the Japanese were confined, so to speak, and in this country, those meet for fear of uprisings or whatever? Is there anything that any of you can share with that? The reason I bring it up there, I have knowledge of a large produce producer in California that their entire family was in, how can I say, what is the term I'm looking for? Interned in during World War II, and they had to sublease out their ground at that time. And when the war was ended, they got their property back, and today they're a very large producer of basically fresh produce in California. But during the World War II years, they were not permitted to engage in commerce in this country. And just wanted to share that with you to see if any of you had any interaction with the Japanese population of this country during World War II.
Well, not during World War II. Well, I was on the East Coast, so I didn't. But
everything went, you know, central part of the country to the east.
About a year ago, our history team had an invitation from a local, a Sacramento Japanese World War II veteran group, and they asked us to come and do our Tuskegee history. So, and there's some of you should know Japanese units.
Yes.
And these were veterans of that. Mm-hmm. Some of those units. I'm not that knowledgeable about it, but they asked us to come and share Tuskegee history with us, and it was very interesting.
Some of the similarities of your exposure. Uh-huh.
And we also, and this has nothing to do with the Japanese, but we had an invitation to share with some Holocaust survivors just the year before last. That was fascinating. All these people who had been, they still had their tattooed. Numbers tattooed on them. Mm-hmm. And one lady, and they were all about our age group anyhow, you know, when you go back that far, I guess you are our age
there
group,
you go. Aren't you?
But one lady said to me, she said, you know, we have very similar experiences, don't we? And I said, yes, we do, because you know how the Jewish people were treated, you know. There are Japanese families now. I mean, I work for one of the school districts there, and several of my colleagues, you know, their parents, and some of them were interred. They were children. And yet not everybody, I don't believe, got their property back.
Right.
I mean, it depended. Mm-hmm.
Did not get it back.
No. It was very, very rare.
They had
24 hours to dispose of everything. And if they had people that were nice, friendly neighbors or whatever, they may do a lease arrangement. But for the most part, they had to sell for pennies on the dollar and just abandon their house and the furniture. Uh-huh. It was a terrible
thing. Yeah,
that's part of a surprise thing. When I was in the produce field some years ago in California, this was all explained to me. Most of you have probably seen labels in the grocery store that read the Bud label or Apple label. This is a family that is associated with, and again, I can't think of the name of the Japanese company that runs these produce farms, but once again, they had to relinquish all their land during the war. Once the war was over, things were given back to them.
No,
they didn't get it back.
Well, in this particular case, that family or those families probably did. But it probably wasn't the norm.
That was not the norm. No.
If you're interested in that, you can read the book Snow Falling on Cedars, and that's about Bainbridge Island in the state of Washington. And there's a movie, too.
Now, I was going to ask, Carl, is there a segment that addresses the Japanese fighting unit or any of those kind of questions that are being posed?
Actually, PBS has been very reluctant to issue large segments of the program. You're talking about...
Yes.
So there are sections of it, major sections of it, that we have not seen.
Okay.
Perhaps, Kimberly,
there's an opportunity. Thank you for asking. There's two things that came up tonight. Yukiko Luan, who is Japanese-American, was interned in California. She's going to be at one of our events. She lives in town, in Champaign. So October 4th at 6:30 p.m. at the Urbana Free Library, you can meet her. Her story is going to be told in one of these segments after Ken Burns. So, again, that's Thursday, October 4th at 6:30 p.m. at the Urbana Free Library. She'll be one of three women on a panel, and she will be talking about being interned because of being Japanese-American. And a Holocaust survivor, Marion Nizan, who's from New York City, is coming back to this area in Charleston on October what, Mary?
25th.
October 25th at what time?
7 p.m.
Wesley United Methodist Church. So you're able to meet with her if you like as well. So just two events coming up as part of our World War II events, and if you need that repeated, you can talk to me or Mary after the program.
Kimberly, do you know whether or not the national program includes anything on the internment camps?
I don't know that. No. We don't have all that information.
No, we don't. They've been very, very tight.
Controlled and managed.
Well, that's
yes.
Right.
What about the boat doctors? The Navajo boat doctors? I'm not sure.
You just have to stay tuned. There you are.
This gentleman up there.
Well, you know.
Yes. We'll take one more question, and please.
A lot of us here are people who know a little bit about World War II, you know, the Korean War, the Vietnam War. We know about these things, but how do we get young people, I mean teenagers today, to really get involved in this? I mean, you look around, there's no teenagers. Pretty soon, many of us will be dead. We won't be here anymore. How do we get these teenage people to understand what has taken place? You know, what this Tuskegee Airmen business was all about? What did Truman do? How did he get a start in the first place? You know, I came from the city of Philadelphia, and, you know, it wasn't great 100% then. You know, even though it's in it all. So how do we get people to understand what is our responsibility in this day and age?
Yes. Go ahead.
This is an excellent question. It's very interesting. I think most of you are familiar with Ken Burns and some of the work he's done in the past. There were two things in particular that stood out to him as being the driving force behind the production of this documentary on World War II. One was the fact that so many veterans are dying off mm-hmm. at such a pace that these stories will be gone forever. And this is allowing us to address some of the, hear about some of these stories that are, we're going to lose irretrievably when people pass on. The other issue that that Burns talked about was the fact that he had seen results of a high school survey about World War II, and the majority of high school students today thought that Germany was one of our allies. And so when we talk about trying to connect with young people and, you know, high school kids and even people in their 20s, this is one of the value of this particular program and of the opportunity to hear from people who live through these times to be able to share these stories with us. So the question you raise is absolutely right on. And that's the challenge we all face. And we need to address it.
I respond to that.
Yeah, go right ahead.
How many of you know that we have a national organization, Tuskegee Airmen, Inc.? Do you know that you can be a member? Our membership is open to anyone. And all we ask you to do, and these are my words, just come in and help us work. Don't just join, pay your dues, and then fade away. Anyone is eligible to be a member of Tuskegee Airmen, Inc., because we focus on scholarships for young people. We particularly emphasize keeping the legacy alive. As far as I know, Chicago is closest thing to Chanute with a chapter of Tuskegee
great.
Airmen, but you're surrounded by Indiana, Ohio, what else in this?
Right, Missouri, et cetera.
You've got chapters in these connecting states. Chanute, start a chapter, get it chartered, get involved with young people. If a lot of kids want to fly. And I say, we don't do the flying lesson, but we can point them in the right direction. If there's a flying school, and you can do something. And are there teachers in here? Any teachers? I don't know what you teach. When Black History Month comes along, what do you do? Anything? Any observance? I bet you do.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you ever recognize maybe Tuskegee Airmen?
Every year we do, but again, we're a little...
That's one school.
One person.
But what
any others? All I'm saying, I'm not harassing you, but all I'm saying is, as individual citizens, you have an opportunity to talk about this. I mean, you need to start. Go to the computer, hit Tuskegee Airmen, and you'll have all kinds of stuff pop up. Right now, we are trying to get this history into the history books. The Alabama Power and Light Company, along with the Memorial Park in Tuskegee, the work that's going on there, Alabama Power and Light has come up with a curriculum about 3 or 4 years ago. There is another one that's even closer to you in Hiram, Ohio, at Hiram College. A man, a professor named Roger Cram, for several years, has, in fact, he belongs to one of the chapters there in Ohio, I think the Cleveland chapter. He's been studying the history of Tuskegee Airmen, and he comes to our convention. He's interviewed me. I mean, we're computer buddies kind of thing. He has put out a curriculum that I like much better than the Alabama Power and Light. Don't tell them, but I like Rogers better because it goes beginning elementary school right on up through college and young adults. And it's very well laid out with activities. The whole thing is laid out for any teacher. But the problem is getting it into the schools. Right, you've got to deal with the Board of Education and the state this and then that. But West Virginia, my hometown, is chartering a chapter as we speak. That is their way of beginning for the area. It's one way. That's all I'm saying. Get involved. And you can be members. Pay your money. That's all you have to do.
And I'd like to mention one more thing, and then our participants will be around for a little while before they have to return to go to sleep for tomorrow. But one of the things that is available to all of you, I assume, who are pretty much local, is, in fact, the museum. And there is information. There is an exhibit in the museum since last year. There were artifacts there prior to that time. There's also a classroom training kit that's at the museum that was developed expressly for classroom teachers to take it, open it up, and share and develop lesson plans from it to address their students. So that material is already available here now and is available for the asking at the museum, to use from the museum. Yes?
Okay, might I also add that the University of Illinois, about 3 years ago, we did a kit that this year we are taking around to all the schools. So if you can let us know what school district you're in, we'll certainly be glad to add you to our list. But we will be going from school to school with the kits, and they're very interactive. And they also follow the guidelines for teaching, as well as the state guidelines for what has to be taught in high school. So we'd be more than happy to come to you. We also need to talk to, the television station a little more to see if we can get a few more of the Prairie Fire types of productions that they put on, because we'd also like some of the information added to the kit. So we would like to get with you guys on that. But we are doing that, and we've already pretty much committed to the Champaign and Urbana school districts, and I'd be glad to include your school district and anybody else that is here that is in this area. We'd be glad to add you to our list. Thank you.
Okay, you have a
quick question. I have one point. Yeah, some of you might want to know that the medal, the Congressional Gold Medal that was awarded to the Tuskegee Airmen, is available to anyone who wants one. If you want one, you can order it very easily on the internet. It's usmint.gov, or you can give them a call.
Some people,
$38. Well, that's for the big one.
That's the big one.
It's about 3 inches, and it's a replica of the gold medal that is displayed in the Smithsonian. And the ones that were awarded.
The inch one is 16. The smaller one is
an inch and a half, I believe. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they are available for anyone. anyone who wants to have one.
Okay, that's an excellent segue. I'm sorry, we're going to need to basically close down a little bit now so that we can kind of keep within our time parameters. But as I said, the participants will be here. I would like to thank each of the participants for traveling in and for their sharing. And there's one other thing. Colonel Jones, good segue, has brought with him this evening, right, for presentation to the museum.
What did you say? I'm sorry.
We're going
to award one of those tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
For display.
Okay.
He has procured
a medal that will be a replica to stay here in the museum with our exhibit. And with that, I'd like to turn the program back over to Kimberly to thank WILL for driving this to happen here for us in Rantoul. We're excited, and hopefully it has been of some great value to each of you.
Thank you, Howard, and Colonel Jones, and Mrs. Roberts, and Mrs. Gingrey for being part of the panel. And thank you for all of you for coming. I thought the interactive discussion was great. And for the teacher who's here, I'm so glad that you talked about what you're doing. All of the local segments that WIL is producing on radio and television and the oral histories that are going to be transcribed, we'll put them all on a teacher's kit, so that you may take those local sources that tell the local history and use it as you teach the World War II history in your classes. So we will be providing that to you. Let's talk after real quick. Thank you. So thank you all for coming. We very much value what you thought of how we did so we can do it better. So we have evaluation forms that Kate will give to you. If you could please fill those out. We take it very seriously. And we hope you'll tune in to WILL this Sunday at 7 for the war. Look for those local segments. Please visit our website. If you know of other local veterans and civilians that want to tell us their story, let us know. We will get that. And you can also submit a story right on our website. You can call it in or you can email it in. And Mr. Freeman's story will be on October 2nd. On WILL TV, and Mr. Jones' segment, we don't have an air date for that yet, but look for these local stories on WILL. And thank you very much, everyone, for coming.
All right.